Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The number of homeless people on America's streets has grown exponentially in recent years. For many, this is a temporary situation, but others are experiencing chronic homelessness. As you walk through almost any downtown in America, you see them. Most ignore them. Public officials count them. But the problem persists. Our guest today has spent his career in public health, caring for these people on the streets and the clinics of Boston and Raleigh. And he says the time has come to address the chronically unhoused. He says to be inhumane is one thing, to be inefficient is another. With our approach to chronic homelessness in America, we are both. This isn't a political statement or social commentary, he says. It's more of a diagnosis, one that I have missed for years. And that's coming from a doctor. He is remedying that situation with his book, In the Gaps, Better Understanding the Expensive Human Suffering of Chronic Homelessness, which offers solutions grounded in what he calls our shared ideals and values. Some of those solutions have bipartisan support, and Dr. Brian Klausner joins us for the hour to share his thoughts. Good morning. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Growing up, I don't remember ever seeing a homeless person on the streets. I think the first time I saw one was during the Reagan administration when I was visiting my parents in Washington and there were people sleeping on grates on the sidewalk. It was shocking then, it is shocking now. But today the population has exploded of these unhoused people. Every city has them, rural areas have them. We're all familiar with that tent city that sprouted up in Los Angeles in the last couple of years. And according to the annual federal report on homelessness by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, more than 770,000 people were living in shelters or outside in January of 2024. That was up 18% from the year before. Those are the latest figures that I have. So why? Why is this happening? Why is this population growing so much?
Well, that's the billion dollar question, right? It is a growing social crisis in America that you referenced is at record highs. You know, we hit record highs last year when the numbers, they released their numbers, you know, every like December. And in 2023, we're like, it went up 12%. We're at record highs. This year, numbers again up another 18%, which is giving testimony to what we're seeing across streets in America. And exactly, I mean, that your question of why is how are we gonna solve this problem? And you know, I start out the book of knowledge of mechanism is everything. And when you start looking at this, you know, how do we solve problems? How do we address issues as a society or in politics or just in our personal life? The key is to solve anything. First, you have to understand it. You have to understand root causes. And then once you understand root causes, you solve it efficiently and ideally in ways that are consistent with your personal or societal values and beliefs. And you know, a lot of those things I think can help unite us. So that's exactly what we're trying to think about. Now, a lot of the numbers that we're seeing right now, a lot of the record highs are being pushed by lack of affordable housing, right? So I think we all can appreciate that the price of housing has outpaced wage growth, especially in lower middle economic sectors. And so from that perspective, if you can't afford a house, if you can't afford a place to live, if you're not getting paid enough money, you know, you'll be homeless. We're seeing, you know, new homelessness, but on the other hand, you know, and what my book focuses on is chronic homelessness, is people who are chronically homeless, usually in the context of a medical or a mental health disorder. People who kind of get stuck in homelessness. And so I think the causes are multifactorial, but that's exactly kind of what we're looking at right now is how do we solve this on both ends of the spectrum? How do we prevent, and we do this in medicine all the time, right? How do you prevent it from occurring in the first place? And then how do you better address more efficiently the chronic forms, the expensive forms? And
So when we talk about, when we think about, when we talk about the homeless or the unhoused, we think about them as this great group of people, which is growing. But that's not what they, that's not, they're not a monolith. That's not what they are. And your book t tells the personal stories of several people that you have worked with over time. And as you say, we can't resolve this situation until we understand the root causes of it and what has gotten these people into the situations they find themselves in. So, what do we need to know about these people as individuals and about how they became part of this growing part of problem in order to understand the problem and in order to search for solutions? What do we need to know about them?
Yeah, I think and part of the reason we wrote the book is we are way off in how we think about homelessness. I would say a quick answer to your question is I have an incredible job where I get to deal with incredible people with incredible strength who are trying to overcome on a daily basis barriers and issues that we can't even begin to imagine. And
I want to stop you right there because that's one of the phrases in the book that leapt off the page. Incredible people with incredible strength. And
oh,
I
yeah.
would bet you that that's the antithesis of how most people think of these folks.
Well, think about everything we hero worship in society. You can kick the ball far, you can put it in a hoop, you can sing really well, right? Whatever it is. One of the most amazing, I say, the book, there's nothing more beautiful than human resilience. And, how so many, so many of my patients are able to wake up every day and just draw resilience out of nothing. Think of everything that makes your life worthwhile. Think of relationships and sense of self-worth and sense of accomplishment and going to work each day. People just, calling you by your name. Like, these are things that a lot of our patients don't get at all every day. And yet they're able to wake up and keep going and overcome. So much of what we've seen and what we talk about in the book is the root causes. So I would say one of the major root causes of chronic homelessness, interestingly, but the science behind this is fascinating, goes back to pediatric trauma, historic trauma, adverse childhood events, which set people on life trajectories that ended up with them being homeless, possibly experiencing addiction on the street. And so many of these patients chronically have been dealing with trauma, complex trauma, mental health, physical health ailments that instead of us working to understand and engage them and improve their outcomes, and by the way, their cost, right? Human suffering is expensive. We are hemorrhaging taxpayer money, tolerating expensive human suffering. But instead of solving it and working with them, we reflexively kind of dehumanize and blame them because it's complicated, because it's messy, because it's not pleasant to think about. Severe trauma, abuse, mental illness, it's not fun to think about. So the easiest thing to do is blame the patients for the pathologies that they're suffering from and move on. The problem with that, that's not the solution. That's not the root cause. It's not self-inflicted. And so our role in medicine or our role as an efficient society is how do you assist these patients, these people, these residents, these humans with the severe pathologies that they're battling through? And yes, it is amazing to watch them because they have a level of strength and resilience in the context of a lot of bias, stereotypes, and dehumanization. And they keep going and they keep trying to live day to day and battle through these things.
There's so much to unpack in what you just talked about. Let's start with this pediatric trauma. Although there are children on the streets and who are homeless, most of these people are adults, and if many of them are going through what they're going through because of unaddressed pediatric trauma, give me some examples of that trauma. What did they experience as a child that has for lack of a better word, crippled them as an adult.
I'm laughing because a lot of the book is like how slow I was to come to realizations of things. I call them my aha moments or my sixth sense moments, where I look up and I'm like, how did I miss this for all these years? But the etiology, the root causes around adverse childhood events. So adverse childhood events are traumatic events that kids face in their life. Neglect, abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, parents suffering from addiction, mental illness, incarceration, death of a loved one, all things that as a kid, when you're growing up, makes your brain just, you're constantly running from the bear. Your brain is developing in constant cortisol. And if and when that happens, it's going to predispose your brain to react in different ways and predispose. So, for instance, the general population, about 4 to 5% have experienced four or more of these adverse childhood events when you do it, across the board. When we did a study with our patients experiencing homelessness and addiction in one of our residential programs here locally, 74%. And so there's this link, and you look at the studies and say, well, people who experience four or more ACEs are 12 to 15 times more likely to use IV drugs, 10 times more likely to commit suicide, but also more likely to have heart disease, more likely to have cancer. And so when your body is swimming in chronic cortisol, it allows you to run from the bear to survive that day, to survive that trauma that they're experiencing on a daily basis as a kid. But it's not good for longevity. It's not good for mental health. It's not good for physical health. And so a lot of what we learned around this root cause, and truly I believe that for chronic homelessness, the major root cause is adverse childhood events and historic trauma. So as we're engaging these patients, about 15 years ago, we're like, we got to treat, and a lot of our patients are $300,000 to $400,000 a year in terms of total societal costs. We're like, we got to treat the heart failure. We got to treat the diabetes so that we don't get an amputation. And then we started getting smart. We said, well, if we don't treat the mental illness, we can't treat the medical illness. Medical illness piece is pretty easy. It's algorithmic. I could teach you how to manage congestive heart failure, right? Like you go through an algorithm, but if it's blocked with schizophrenia, bipolar disease, severe anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, you can't treat that. So then we got smart. We said, well, we got to treat mental health more efficiently if we hope to treat the physical health. And then about 3 or 4 years, about 5 or 6 years ago now, said, oh my God, a lot of the mental health is related to the historic trauma. We have to go back and address the trauma that led to the behavioral health. And we started doing that. And it was eye-opening and it was awesome. And we started to get incredible outcomes because we started to address root causes instead of just blaming the patients for their symptoms. And it was eye-opening and it was awesome. And it opened a bunch of therapeutic doors that were shut previously.
Not everybody who is homeless is chronically homeless. There are two types of people who fall into it because of an economic, temporary economic situation, because many people live paycheck to paycheck, and that one big bill, and they're done. They lose the house, they can't pay the rent, they get evicted, etc. But then there are the chronically homeless. I have 50, 30 seconds here. What is the fundamental difference? Is it mental illness?
Mental illness, physical illness, and severe trauma. And so I think those would be the main differences.
So you talked about the high societal cost of caring for these patients, and many of these patients depend on the high on have to deal with this high societal cost because they can't afford health care. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about that and how that impacts these folks who are struggling to survive on a day-to-day basis. Dr. Brian Klausner is with us, Executive Medical Director of the Wake Med Center for Community Health Innovation and Equity, and author of In the Gaps. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Brian Klausner is with us. He's Executive Director of the Medical Director of the Wake Med Center for Community Health Innovation and Equity, and he has written about his work experience working with homeless people, both on the streets and in the clinics of Boston and Raleigh, where he is now, in the gaps, better understanding the expensive human suffering of chronic homelessness is the name of the book. The lack of affordable housing you talked about a little bit at the beginning of the conversation, and that's part of the root cause of this problem, as well as pediatric trauma and other kinds of mental health issues. The high cost of medicine has been felt by companies, by individuals across this country for a very long time. But you write, quote, "The most impacted were the working poor, those who didn't qualify for Medicaid, but who weren't provided health insurance by their employers. They were left uninsured and susceptible to poor health outcomes and their associated financial consequences. Even for those who had insurance, medical bills can bankrupt you." This state, resisted expanding Medicaid for a very long time until just the recent past. You've been on the front lines. Has the expansion helped the most vulnerable among us?
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in. Yes, absolutely. Yes. And then, and I think, again, it goes back to getting away from partisan ideas, getting away from politics, just going into problem solving and efficient use of taxpayer money. And so, yes, you created, so much of medicine historically has kind of been this fee for service. It's more of a business model where we just get paid to do things to patients. So there was no real financial incentive to keep patients healthy if we got paid a lot for fixing them when they came in broken. We'd fix them. If they went back into the community, they broke again, they'd come back into the hospital and we'd fix them again and be well reimbursed for those who could afford it. For those who couldn't, they were neglected and left without the care that they needed. So you saw these healthcare disparities grow. You saw around socioeconomic lines. But what you also saw in that system, which is fascinating, and I talk about this in the book, we spend more on this country on the healthcare 1% of our population than we do on public education. K through 12. Or we spend a lot more in this country on 1% of our population's healthcare than we do on military, far more on military. So you think about that gross inefficiency and you look at, well, who are those patients? 1% of our population is responsible for 25% of our medical cost. Small minority responsible for a large percent of the cost. And by the way, our cost is what? $4.6 trillion, the most expensive healthcare system in the country. So you look at that and you're like, we are hemorrhaging money in what ultimately is avoidable human suffering. And to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. So how do you solve that? How if we're responsible for efficiently utilizing taxpayer money in whether across society and also in medicine as well, how do you solve that? So you start going into that 1% and you start saying, well, what are the risk factors? And some are, you get in a car accident, you're in a coma for 6 months. That's not avoidable. But a lot of it is avoidable, driven by social determinants of health, driven by poverty, driven by not being able to get medications, driven by not having housing. So you start looking at like, can we better merge healthcare with social services to be more efficient? Again, not related to any political agenda or ideology, just from an efficiency perspective. But that's the root cause that's costing America, $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion on spending on 1% of our population, the healthcare of 1% of the population. Let's solve it and let's do it in a smart way and let's hold ourselves accountable for how we do it efficiently and humanely.
Do policymakers understand this? Do they know this? And if they know it, why wouldn't they? We have a tr several trillion dollar debt. Why wouldn't they want to address this?
I think it goes back to the business of medicine. Like it was kind of a victimless crime, right? Like, so the hospital systems would get paid a lot, healthcare would get paid a lot, and the companies would just pass that on, corporations. Or the insurance companies would pass it on to the corporations. Now, I think corporate America has been screaming about it for a long time. But Warren Buffett calls American healthcare system the tapeworm of our economy that really impacts our ability to compete, internationally. So I think people have been talking about, but there is such that financial incentive. There's a, people are making money off the $4.5, $4.6 trillion. But finally, what you're getting is corporations, government, Medicaid, Medicare, we spend 20% of our GDP on healthcare, and it's been trending up. And that can't go to 30%. It can't go to 40%. So finally, what you're seeing in the last decade is people say, wait a minute, like, it's this pivot from fee-for-service, where you just get paid to fix the broken, to quote-unquote value-based care, where hospital systems are saying, hey, you're going to get reimbursed for how healthy you keep a population. It's a complete...
So if Warren Buffett says this is the tapeworm in American economics and we can't be competitive until we figure this out, that leads to a question from one of our listeners who just sent us an email who says, is the homeless situation similar in other developed countries? Is this an indictment of our capitalist system's failure? Is this a problem that communist nations face as well? There are not many communist nations left, but nonetheless, is it?
Yeah, I mean, countries across the world are obviously deal with homelessness. And in poorer countries, you're going to have higher rates of homelessness. I think in America, for being such a wealthy country, this growing crisis, and not only is it bad, but it's getting worse. You know, with recent numbers, 750,000 people who are homeless, about 20% of that is chronic homelessness. So I do think it is, and there's people that study, I have not studied a lot from an international perspective. Jim O'Connell, who wrote the foreword in my book, has done a lot going into other countries and looking at their issues there. But I do think, to answer your question, that the gap is a little bit uniquely American, and especially the chronic homelessness, where we're allowing a lot of people to suffer very expensively, you know, again, preventable human suffering of chronic homelessness, 150,000, that were that disconnect between medicine and social services, which is kind of uniquely American. The fact that medicine and social services really evolved independent from one another, and now with this push, we're trying to merge them back together. But that is a little bit uniquely American. And I think our tolerance for the expense and the cost and the suffering and the mortality. So people who are chronically homeless, their average age of death is around 50.
Right. Since you can't solve a problem until you understand it, and you have to understand the root causes of it, I think you also understand how we need to understand how we got here. Otherwise, we'll just revert back to how we got here again and go through the whole thing all over again. So, as I said, as a kid, I don't remember ever seeing a homeless person. Yeah. What has changed? Why can't people? Well, we know that things are more expensive, but this is the richest country in the world, and we are richer today than we have ever been in the history of the country, and the richest society the world has ever known. And yet we have this problem that we didn't seem to have in the 50s, in the 60s. What changed?
Well, I think it's probably a lot of different answers to that. I think a couple of the main ones would be just the discrepancy between housing prices and wage growth. And
what role did the Reagan administration play when he decided to close down mental institutions that were helping people who had childhood trauma, et cetera?
Yeah. I think that played a big factor. I mean, that was one of the, so I think that was going to be the second one that I mentioned. So I think it's our failure to really address, especially mental illness. I can talk about that in a little bit, the root cause as to why we're not addressing mental illness efficiently. That over the last couple of decades, I think we're getting in some regards worse in how we're addressing mental illness. And then this lack of affordable housing. I mean, we've seen, due to lack of legislation around affordable housing, we've always kind of circled early 2020s as we're going to see a rise in homelessness, because it's a predictable pattern of people just can't afford housing. And with the price of housing, we knew that was going to happen. COVID lit a match to it, though. And so I think, you know, worsening how we address mental illness, combined with the lack of affordable housing, combined with COVID, that kind of was an impetus to a lot of this, kind of explains why we're seeing some record numbers right now.
Yeah, I think it also speaks to that we think of them as this group. The homeless, the unhoused, and we see them on the streets and we avoid them, assiduously avoid them for the most part, which I want to talk about. But you wrote an op-ed piece recently for the Raleigh News and Observer in which you humanized these people, pointing out that the list of people that the city compiled, that the city of Raleigh compiled, contained the names of too many brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, wives and husbands, cousins, childhood best friends, teammates and first loves, all sons and daughters. We don't think of them that way. What would change if we did?
Well, and then you're bringing up, and Mike, this is really, you know, the book is about homelessness, but on a bigger scale, it's really about our human tendencies to dehumanize populations. And that's not some abstract philosophical, like the science behind that is fascinating. So we've talked a lot about what's the root causes and the pathologies of people who are experiencing homelessness, but it's two-sided. What's our pathologies? What's our inherent pathologies and how we address? Why are we tolerating expensive human suffering? And it's funny because initially, my initial title for the book was called Hypocritical Gaps. And my first editor is like, you're going to lose half your audience. you can't call it that. But what I talk about is, and I truly believe, like all these ideals and principles and values that we loudly profess in our living rooms, congregations, boardrooms, classrooms. We all, I think, and these are things that unite us. And that's not be Pollyannish or, you know, looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. Like, we are united by common principles. We all want to be a more humane, more awesome society, healthier society, more efficient society. What's the gap? What's the barrier? What causes these hypocritical gaps between how we want to act and how we actually act? And that's why we do try to humanize, because what the science shows, and we talked about the research in the book about Dr. Lasana Harris, it was fascinating. So he stuck a bunch of subjects under functional MRIs that look at your brain activity. And he would flash different pictures of different populations, a police officer, a school teacher, military. And then he would do a stereotypical picture of homeless addict. And in every person, and what he was studying, he was trying to figure out, he's a social cognitive scientist. We used to be up at Duke before he went over to England. Mm-hmm. He was studying, how do we tolerate human atrocities historically, whether it be Rwanda, you know, Nazi Germany. Majority of Germans in Nazi Germany were Christians. How do they tolerate human atrocities against a population? And that was his whole focus. And he did it studying people who were experiencing homelessness. And what they saw in this picture is, in every picture, and they would only flash up for a second, the prefrontal cortex lit up. That's the part of the brain that involves humanization and love and, you know, all these things, besides the quote unquote homeless addict. And with that, no prefrontal cortex activity, conflict resolution, the part of the brain involved with conflict resolution lit up. And so what he was showing is that when I talk with people and they're like, I don't feel empathy. I wish I could, but I just want to tell them to get a job. You know, when what his research was showing was that we have this tendency to reflexively dehumanize various populations. And I'll get to the which seems very dark and very ugly result. But it was actually pretty awesome because he went back and in the study, it didn't take much to light up the prefrontal cortex. So he would come in and just say some characteristic about the person. You know, this is a person that grew up in Los Angeles. She likes walks. She does, and all of a sudden the prefrontal cortex light up. So his theory was that we have a human reflexive tendency to avoid empathy because it's painful and it takes time. The easiest thing for us to do is say, get a job, it's their fault, and we move on.
And it puts us on the hook. It makes us responsible for doing something.
It does, and it would also paralyze us. I would say, if you were saying you see it on the Charlotte streets, if you actually stopped and appreciated the level of suffering for every individual that you met, you would be paralyzed. It would, because it is severe. In his conclusion in terms of the atrocity things is, okay, so you dehumanize people. So in it Hitler, it was, he would call Jewish people rats and vermins, or in Rwanda, it was cockroaches. And you started seeing that with homeless. It's addicts, it's bums, it's this, that, or the other. And so we have that human tendency that a lot of people will kind of tap into and try to manipulate to polarize us, but we have a human tendency toward dehumanization. Yeah. That blocks us from realizing the humanity of people. And that's why I started that op-ed with that, is to stop, because we all know that they're human, but our body instinctively wants to not recognize that so we can move on in our life and not worry about them as we worry about ourselves.
And it's one of the reasons you share some stories of some of the people with whom you have dealt, which I want to get into in a moment. But let me get back to this comment you just made, because a lot of people do say, because we see them on the street corners, we are accosted by, that's a bad word, we are approached by homeless people sometimes on the street who want money. You sometimes you give them money because you feel bad. They want lunch, they want something to eat, and you hope that they will use it for food and not something else. But you pass these people on street corners and you think, why don't you just get a job? Wouldn't that be better than standing in the broiling sun or the freezing cold for 8 hours a day and coming up with a tin can to your window in the car? Why don't you just get a job? Why is that? How is that wrong? And what are their options? Because you say that many of these people die in the dehumanization of loneliness and isolation, unassisted by local homeless resources that have struggled in recent years to keep up with the spike in homelessness. We do have shelters, we do have services, but these folks choose not to use them?
Yeah. I would ask, why can't I ask my patient with an amputated arm to raise his hand, right? Because he doesn't have the ability to do so. And sometimes when you're looking at these patients who are suffering from chronic homelessness, and I use that example in the book of Mr. Spears, that people who are suffering from severe trauma and or behavioral health disease, and a lot of times if we can address that, if we can treat it, we can get them to a spot where they can be functional, can get a job, and can be productive. But a lot of it is a better understanding of the root cause. I can tell you that almost no homelessness is self-inflicted. No one grows up and says, I want to be suffering from homelessness on the street, panhandling, and being reflexively dehumanized by every person that I see. And so it's not like the self-inflicted thing. And so that is the big question. But how do we understand why they're there? And it starts with, and I will tell people, you know, if you recognize that you have, I have, we all have this reflexive dehumanization. So recognize it in yourself, see, you know, look them in the eye, smile, ask their name, humanize them for a second. And from an individual perspective,
I never thought about this till I looked through your book, and you say that many times these people never hear their names ever. No one talks to them. No one calls them by their name. And that is also exacerbating the problem. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. In Charlotte Talks, I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about homelessness and possible solutions to it and understanding the problem so that we can better attempt to solve it. Dr. Brian Klausner is a medical doctor who has worked with the homeless, both on the streets and in clinics in Boston and now in Raleigh, where he is the executive medical director of the WakeMed Center for Community Health, Innovation, and Equity. He is also the author of In the Gaps, Better Understanding the Expensive Human Suffering of Chronic Homelessness. In this book, you share a lot of stories of some of the people that you've treated. You've changed their names to protect them. In fact, you've dedicated your book to one of the persons that you did not change their name because she gave you permission to use it. Joanne Guarino, is that how you say her last name?
Yes, correct.
You call her the strongest person you have ever known. But each of the people that you write about in this book have their own story. Is there a through line here that will carry through some sort of theme or commonality that all of them share?
I think, you know, in the first chapter, it's that theme of there's nothing more beautiful than human resilience and more inspiring than human resilience. And that's the theme is, you know, the tragedy is, again, most of these patients are no longer with us. Joanne is, thank God, and she's alive and, you know, thriving and changing systems and doing all her stuff, which is amazing. But most of these patients have passed. And that's the real tragedy, is you had beautiful, incredibly resilient humans that wasn't recognized in their lifetime, that they died unappreciated and that resilience wasn't seen. And so I think the theme is that these are incredible people, that the resilience is amazing. It's nothing that we can probably even relate to. And what
So,
we learned.
Joanne is the strongest person you say you've ever met. She was able to get out of homelessness. She now works with that population, and as I understand it, she speaks to groups of people to help them understand the realities of what it means to be and why homelessness exists. Was she able to get off the streets because of her personal strength or because of your application of the lessons that you've learned that you were able to apply to her care over time?
I think it's her personal strength, like so many of our patients, her personal strength that was assisted by the systems that would support her from a medical and a physical and mental health perspective. And the minute she got out, she went right back in to help others, to help pull people out. And now, she's talking in front of Harvard Med School, business schools nationally across the country to basically do what the book tries to do as well, is humanize the problem. If we reflexively discard, we're not gonna be using our brains. We're not gonna be trying to think through this process. The first step is to humanize. And I think she is a beautiful example, not only her example where we are able to see her humanity, but her ability to humanize others and humanize the problem is inspiring and kind of a role model for me.
I want you to share one of the other stories that might resonate with our listeners, because one of these individuals that you worked with over time, who is no longer with us, is a fellow named Mike, and he was an NPR listener. This is a homeless person, an NPR listener. Talk to me about Mike.
Oh man, that guy, talk about human resilience. I put that in the chapter around spirituality, and how so often we don't appreciate the humanity. So Mike was someone that, was a patient that lived in his car outside of a local restaurant and suffered from heart failure, suffered from severe pain, was too nervous in shelter. So, like so many, so you had mentioned earlier, well,
And to back up, the reason he was homeless is because he couldn't work because of his physical disabilities, which were legitimate. That comes from years of what, working in restaurant kitchens and standing up, etc. He couldn't do that anymore.
he was a cook, then he had three heart attacks. And he suffers from some mental health issues as well. But yeah, it doesn't take much sometimes to push people into homelessness. And then especially if you're sick, you're gonna get stuck there, right? And that's what happened to Mike. But so I would go up. His morning routine is every morning he'd wake up and he had a prayer card and he would pray for 30 minutes and then he would turn on NPR. And so I couldn't get him into the clinic. He wouldn't come into the hospital, so I would just go visit him, as part of our outreach. And whenever I went up there, he would always start talking about whatever he heard on it was WUNC, our local station, whatever he heard that day. And he it was the most fascinating intellectual conversations that I couldn't keep up with. And so finally, I was said, screwed. I had to start listening every morning just so I could kind of keep up with him from his. And he was one of the smartest guys that you ever met. But again, and his love of life and his boisterous laugh, and he had all these animals around him. So he loved, he had some squirrels, he had the birds, he'd feed them, like, and he had like this, it wasn't only resilience, it was kind of like this joy, that was such a contradiction to the situation that he was in.
Well, I believe, is he not the person that could find beauty in almost anything? I mean, he's a guy who has absolutely nothing, and yet he was able to find beauty in the smallest things around him.
Yeah, and I say that in the book that a lot of us suffer in our imagination more in reality. We complain a lot about things that are maybe not really worth complaining about, and he reversed the script. He never complained about anything, even though he had everything to complain about. And again, talk about a role model. I mean, talk about how do you deal with these issues in your life in a way that, like, I mean, it's almost miraculous when you're with them. You're like, how, where does this come from? But you see him on the street, and he did panhandle. You see him on the street, reflexively label him as a bum, move on, addict, whatever. He didn't suffer from addiction, but. Like, that's the thing. That's what we're missing. Like,
Let
this
me
incredible human beauty
I
and
know
resilience.
I know you treat these folks medically, but let me ask you how we should be treating them. How should we interact? Because we are approached from time to time, whether it's a walking down the street, they're asking for a money for lunch or whatever it may be, or just walking past them. What would sh should we don't acknowledge them. We generally don't look at them. We generally want to be away from them. So what should we do?
And there's no greater pain than dehumanization. We all know it. If we get dehumanized, if someone treats us poorly, we know that's painful. So I think the big thing, don't dehumanize. And as you think about that, recognize the fact that you will dehumanize because you have this human reflex of dehumanization. You don't want to empathize with their suffering. So the first thing, as we talk about in the book, is just pause. Just stop, pause, make eye contact. Smile, maybe ask them a question. Just pause to humanize. But whatever you do, don't dehumanize. Take a second and just like they did in the study, went in and said, hey, this is Mary. She's from North Carolina. She likes bananas or whatever it is. Take a second, ask them a question, humanize them. And I give the story about Blue Honeycutt in the book where she said, you know, the greatest gift that you can give someone is compassion and humanization. As greater than any monetary thing that you give somebody. So that would be my advice to people because I get asked that all the time is pause, listen, think, humanize, love. You know, and yeah, it can go to that. That's how you can't love if you're dehumanizing. And if you can show them at least that humanization that leads to like that, that's the biggest thing you can do for them.
Many of these folks have experienced trauma in their lives, as you have said. Heck, losing a job, losing your house, being evicted from your apartment is traumatic. Living on the street is even more so. It's more of a stressor than perhaps anything most of us could possibly imagine. Once you find yourself in that situation, is it like a snowball rolling downhill? And if so, is there a way to melt away the snow to get to the nugget of the problem?
But it is really hard work. There's a lot of things that snowball into really bad, expensive. You don't get the poor outcomes that we see. You don't see mortality around 50. You don't see patients that are costing $500,000 a year without. That's the end result of snowballs that have gotten out of control. And so a lot of what we see, especially with if you're constantly dehumanized, a lot of times that will lead, you're gonna protect yourself from that. So you see a lot of social isolation, people going into the woods, people avoiding going into the hospitals or coming to see doctors. And so trauma builds on trauma, definitely. And it gets and a lot of times that's a snowball that starts really early on in childhood. And so a lot of what we try to do is prevent. So a lot of our work is better managing the chaos downstream. You know, these patients that cost $400,000 or $500,000, $600,000, quantifying the savings of that. If we're more humane and if we're more efficient, and Housing First is a perfect example of this, we're able to plummet the costs and we can say, hey, instead of $600,000 this year, we spent $50,000. We just saved $550,000. Let's reinvest a portion of that into pediatric mental health, into prevention programs, and prevent badness before it snowballs into chaos.
You've had all these aha moments along the way, which you've talked a little bit about, and you go into great detail in the book, but most people have not. So is this a tough sell, even for you within the medical community, to take this different approach, take this understanding of the costs that we are incurring with what we're doing now and how we could save money by changing our approach?
I don't think so, but I'm biased. But no, I think that's what makes it bipartisan, right? If we can say, and we've done that, we've done that. So we started this whole program with analytics where we said, hey, these patients are costing $200,000 a year. We're in charge of efficiently managing these patients. Let's hold ourselves accountable. What are we doing wrong? And now we even push that out into societal cost. So we're going to legislators, and we're saying, healthcare costs is one thing, but these patients are also living in prison systems and jails and homeless shelters and ambulances.
But like
And we're
so
looking
many
at
things that seem to people reach out and they cleave to very simplistic solutions and very simplistic descriptions of the problem. This is Byzantine. It's an economic problem. It is a housing problem. It is a policy problem. It is a medical problem. It is a societal problem. It is an individual problem. Where do you start?
Bipartisan solutions with intuitive data, to your point, that says take away the humanity. And as you started out, one thing to be inefficient, another thing to be inhumane, we're being both. Take away whatever argument you want to go. You want to go at a humanistic argument? Fine, we got that. You want to go at a efficiency? Fine, we got that too. And then if you're in charge of efficiently using taxpayer money, explain why we just spent $600,000 on preventable human suffering. And so I do think, and by the way, homelessness, and even in 2025, we have to remember this. It's always been pretty bipartisan. Housing First was mainly George Bush. I mean, there's been a lot of bipartisan agreement that we can still, even, I'm still optimistic, even in 2025, we can make this intuitive, we can make it data, and we can make it about taxpayer efficiency in avoiding human suffering that's really expensive. So I'm still optimistic that there are solutions there that we can flip, especially in my niche of chronic homelessness. We can do, there's so much low-hanging fruit, we can do a whole lot better.
And the reason it's expensive has been our approach, but also the way our system, such as it is, has been set up. It's not really a healthcare system. It is a hodgepodge, and it's for profit for the most part. And early in your life, when you had no intention of becoming a doctor, and you were just thinking about it, your grandfather, I understand, was a physician. And when you told him you were thinking about it, there was this long pause in the conversation. Yeah. And he suddenly said, always remember that medicine is not a career. It is a vocation. That doesn't seem to be how the healthcare system is approached.
I think that was a reason for his long pause, is that it was in the mid 90s and he saw where medicine was headed. You know, I expected him to jump up and down, cry and say, you know, yeah, awesome. You know, he didn't. He hesitated because I think he saw where medicine was going. And so and that's resonated almost every day because you're right. That he meant that as a warning, not as an advertisement. And he was right. I do think as we pivot to value-based care, as we look at the costs and we reach a breaking point, that ultimately medicine will, out of necessity, go back into the vocational mode because human suffering is expensive. And if we're held accountable for the expense of the suffering rather than just profiting from it, I don't think it's Pollyannish to think that, and we're always starting to see these changes. I mean, the center right here is a testament to these changes. So I think we're going in the right direction. We just have to attack it.
So you've been interacting with these people and dealing with the manifestation of the problem of being homeless and what leads to it for a long time. And you did it in Boston. Now you're in Wake County. And you say that over time, the medical teams with whom you've worked evolved to better understand the root causes of chronic homelessness. With that as an underpinning, what should we be doing? What should medicine be doing? What should we be doing as a society?
Yeah, I think we should be trying to minimize the cost and the poor outcomes, quantify the cost savings of doing that, and then demonstrate the intuitive that if you treat root causes instead of just getting paid to treat their symptoms, you're gonna have improved outcomes. So identify the root causes, trauma, mental health. There are some patients like that. My patient that you talked about, Mike, he cannot live on the streets with heart failure. Housing First, programs that we have so many, and we're starting to do this, that we have people in housing right now. We can come back $1 million patients over 2 years that are dropping into $70,000 or $80,000. Again, human suffering is expensive. Avoiding it is cost efficient. And so these intuitive solutions around chronic homelessness. Now, this whole other realm of rising new acute homelessness, those are different solutions with housing options. I mean, that's a more challenging topic to focus on. But when it comes to chronic homelessness, treat root causes, especially trauma, behavioral health, use Housing First efficiently, and then hold ourselves accountable for how we do that and the costs associated with it.
Who do you hope reads this book? I have 30 seconds.
Everybody, but especially, you know, people in medicine. I initially wrote it for medicine, and then this broader theme of dehumanization and the human pathologies about how we empathize made it more for a general audience.
Dr. Brian Klausner is the Executive Medical Director of the Wake Med Center for Community Health, Innovation, and Equity. His book is called In the Gaps, Better Understanding the Expensive Human Suffering of Chronic Homelessness. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.